prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror movies, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
And I'm Lance.
And two things before we jump into our first episode of this year's April Showers of Blood. I did want to just say a quick thank you to everyone who sent their condolences to me on Instagram. Even if I didn't respond, I saw your thoughtfulness. So thank you. And I thank you. And so does Ridley. On a very different note, I would like to address a previous concern of yours, Lance.
Uh-oh.
So you've expressed some disappointment about how none of the movies that you've picked for our Blu-ray wishlist episodes have ever gotten released. At least as of this recording.
Right.
But your track record with picking movies for regular episodes and then those getting a release is insane.
It's true. Yeah. A lot of the stuff I've picked, and I'm kind of hopeful for my April Showers of Blood pick.
Ooh, okay. There's a lot. So just for folks who aren't up to speed on all of our episodes, the most recent announcement comes from Scream Factory, who is releasing The Strangler. Starring Victor Buono, which was all of these are Lance's picks. Primal Rage just got 4K from Vinegar Syndrome.
Fuck yes.
Which is insane. Say the word, I'll be there. Now that movie did have a previous Blu-ray release from Dark Sky, but that doesn't count because they gave it no love. There's no good special features on it. It's just, that doesn't count. Smile Before Death. Didn't just get a Blu-ray, but it also got a soundtrack. So I'm counting that double for you.
Yeah, I know. I need to pick that up. I didn't get it on vinyl, so.
You should.
I know, because we all know the song.
Don't put it back in.
Don't
I mean,
do it.
I mean, people have it on vinyl now, so.
Sorry, guys.
It's all right. Then you picked Hell High, and that was like right before Arrow had their announcement released for that. Same thing with The Third Eye, that came like right on the heels of Arrow announcing that, so you had it picked before that got announced.
Yeah.
The Devonsville Terror, another Vinegar Syndrome release.
Yeah, damn, okay. They're really racking up.
Yeah, and Lady Frankenstein too.
Yes.
Is in that Dance Macabre set from Severance. So, I mean, you're cleaning up when it comes to picking those things. Because I think I've got like three. So Blood Delirium, Mill of the Stone Women, and Black Pit of Dr. M. I know the Oracle got a Blu-ray release from Media Blasters, but that's all like...
Did Scalpel get a release? No?
That had one before I picked
it. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think The Strangler is, it's kind of a surprising pick because you don't see a whole lot of old, you know, especially, well, I guess Scream Factory does, but I don't know. When I saw that announcement, I was like, oh, hey.
I would have expected Kino to put something like that
up.
But yeah, I mean, it's great. Either way, we'll take it. And so, yeah, you should feel great about.
I do.
We'll
see what happens with this next one.
Well, we'll cross our fingers with this next April Showers of Blood pick, also for Arcana, because.
Yes.
That needs it.
Yeah, we need Julia Questi out there.
Yeah. But before we get to Lance's April Showers of Blood pick, we're going to start with mine.
And it's a good one.
I'm glad you think so. And so my pick for April Showers of Blood is Pure Blood or Pura Sangre from 1982. This is available to watch on Vimeo. I'll put a link to where you can watch it in show notes. It's also on our previous episode show notes if you grabbed it from there. And as of this recording, this has 840 views on Letterboxd. So Pure Blood is about a millionaire, Robert Hurtado. He's like a sugar baron. He suffers from a rare disease for which the only treatment is transfusions of the blood of young boys. So Robert's son enlists employees from their company. And I say enlists, I mean blackmails. He finds out that three of his employees are involved in these other murders that have happened. He finds these photographs and he's like, oh, I'm going to hang on to these. And he ends up saying, I've got these photos. You need to do this thing for me. Otherwise, I'm taking these photos to the police. So he knows that they are already these sadistic people that are capable of committing murder and doing horrendous things, and that blood doesn't scare them. So he says, I need you to get blood for my father pretty much by any means necessary. Getting into the cast and crew, I'm going to do something a little bit different for this because a lot of the cast and the crew, I'm really only going to focus on a couple of people because pretty much everyone involved with this film is part of a collective of filmmakers and artists called Kaliwood, C-A-L-I-Wood. And that's their nickname because they're from Cali, Colombia. So Kaliwood, this collective of filmmakers and artists during the 1970s, 1980s, they made a handful of films. They were artists, photographers. Most of them were, you know, communists, and a lot of the messages in their works were very anti-fascist. So you see some of that coming through, not just in this work, but in a lot of the films and works of other people in that group. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, this, especially in the 1980s, Cali, Colombia is most well known for the Cali cartel, or, you know, cocaine being sort of at its height. And that actually kind of shows up in this film as well with the group of the criminals in this. So many of the actors that were part of Caliwood, they had more prolific careers in television when government funding for films dried up. And there is actually a museum in Cali, Colombia, the Caliwood Museum. So if you ever find yourself there for some reason, you can check it out. They've got some neat memorabilia and artifacts from that group of folks.
Nice.
So one of the main people that was part of Caliwood was the director of this film, Luis Ospina. He actually died in September of 2019. His last film was a 3.5-hour documentary called It All Started at the End from 2015. I did watch it. It feels like a 3.5-hour documentary. So the prologue and the epilogue are about Ospina dealing with cancer. So it starts with him like in the hospital and like getting his diagnosis and all. And that's about a half hour or so long. And then it has him being discharged from the hospital, and they get into sort of like the first part of the film. It feels more like the second part because the prologue is extremely long. So all of the people who were part of Caliwood having this sort of reunion dinner, sharing stories, and it's intercut with clips from the movies that they talk about that they worked on. So my biggest issue here with this documentary is that it feels less like a documentary to entertain or inform an audience who is unfamiliar with this group and their works, and more of a collection of recordings and film clips and stories about each other. So it just feels like Ospina made it for himself and his friends in this group. Now, I'm not going to tell a dying man how to make his documentary. It's just that at 3.5 hours, I only really wrote down a few notes, and most of those were to remind me to look up something else related to this. So I didn't actually gain that much insight from it other than, you know, a few notes. Personally, I hate, especially when this is someone's like last work and it's clearly very personal to him.
Right.
But what I would have liked to have seen is a more focused documentary, a shorter documentary, about this collective of artists who they were doing these great things in a region that at the time and still to this day is most known for the Cali cartel and for cocaine. You know, I had never heard the term Caliwood before watching this film and starting to dig into it. And I'm sure a lot of other folks haven't either. They think of Colombia, they think of cocaine. They don't think of something like this. So,
yeah.
And I'm not saying that the documentary doesn't have that, but it's not focused enough on that for you to really gain an understanding of it from the outside. It feels like it was made like, hey, let's make a thing for us.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, because I've read a little bit about the Caliwood, you know, group with, you know, Carlos Meola, who we'll talk about, and Ospina, but they had like such dark underlying humor and like the audacity of a lot of their stuff that they filmed.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe that, you know, this was his last hurrah. It's definitely a personal film. He's probably like, what do people expect and want from a documentary? Okay, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I could see him, based on his previous works that I saw, the very few, and just in Pure Blood, and what I read about that collective, they're very like, let's do exactly what people don't want, and this is what we want. So, yeah, I'm interested. I saw that you watched it. I saw the runtime, and I was like, damn, that is very off-putting. But yeah. I would like to check it out someday, even if it doesn't sound very informative.
I'm glad that I watched it, especially for this. But and it was even better. You know, I had watched Pure Blood for the first time last year. I watched this documentary and then I rewatched Pure Blood, and I saw a lot more after learning more about these people. And so it helps. It enhances the viewing of it, but God, it's fucking 3.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry you died of cancer, but like, can you make a separate documentary about that? Thanks. So the only other narrative film that Ospina directed besides Pure Blood was called Breath of Life from 1999. This is on YouTube. It has subtitles. I wouldn't recommend it. It's a very boring neo-noir murder mystery. I think I gave it 2 stars. The majority of the work that Ospina did were documentaries. And many of these were co-directed by Carlos Maiallo. And a lot of them frequently reference blood or social or figurative vampirism. One from 1975, directed by both of them, is called Asuncion. It's a short film, about 17 minutes long. It's about a housemaid getting vengeance against the family that hired her. There's a scene of her pouring blood into a sauce that's going to be served to her employers, signifying that they lived well off of her blood, both figuratively and now literally. And then I think the documentary that they're most well known for is the short 30-minute one called The Vampires of Poverty. And this really sort of encapsulates the subject matter that they were often concerned with within their work. In this one specifically, they're sort of subverting what journalists were doing by making money off of shooting film of impoverished people on the streets, or they called it poverty porn. And so what they did is they had these sort of two different groups of people. They had one who they were like, these are the vampires, these are the leeches coming in and filming, and they showed them. And then they took this other group of people who were actually interviewing those people who were being filmed and getting their comments about that. So this got them quite a bit of attention. And again, like, this whole social vampirism is like kind of the through line through a lot of the works of Hollywood. Very anti-capitalist, very concerned with the haves taking from the have-nots and the growing economic disparities. So all of these ideas, this idea of social vampirism, and along with a true crime scenario that I'll talk about in a little bit, that all served as inspiration for this script, for Pure Blood, which was co-written by Alberto Quiroga, who is another member of Hollywood. But I do want to get back to Carlos Maiallo, the co-director. He was another prominent figure within that group, within that collective. He died in 2007. He directed 13 films and starred in 11. He is in Pure Blood as one of the actors. He plays Perfecto, one of the 3 criminals in the gang. He's also in Werner Herzog's Cobra Verde. He's the governor of Bahia, the one who basically gives a contract to Klaus Kinski's character, Cobra Verde. And there's actually other members of the Hollywood collective that worked as crew, mostly second unit, assistant director, camera, things like that. So there's a connection to like more well-known films at the very least. And then one other cast member I did want to talk about was the man who played Robert Hurtado. His name was Gilberto Forero, and his character was actually based on a famous businessman from Cali at that time, Adolfo Ariztizabal. Apologies for mispronouncing that. So it was a combination of, we're focused on this idea of these vampires sucking the life out of, you know, the the rich exploiting the lower class.
Right.
And then you have this famous businessman from Cali at the time. He's a real estate developer. Clearly, like, they have some issues with him because even though Hurtado is not necessarily the main villain in this, he's clearly like
the godfather, where the people below him are doing all the dirty work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got his character being based off of this real estate mogul in Cali at the time, as well as a Cali serial killer who was never caught, called the Monster of the Mangones, aka the Cali Vampire. And Mangones means the wasteland, so Monster of the Wasteland. So this was an unidentified Colombian serial killer from Cali, obviously. Between the 1960s and 70s, murdered between 30 and 40 boys. Because he used needles, it was widely speculated that he took blood from the boys, earning him or her, we don't know, probably him though, the nickname of, you know, the Cali Vampire or the Monster of the Mangones. Puro Sangue premiered or screened at the Cartagena Film Festival in Colombia. Luis Ospina was asked by a member of the press, quote, "How did you manage to spend so much money making a piece of shit?" while another reviewer called it the first Colombian horror film with international quality. So I think overall it got good reviews, but I think because this was so different than anything else that had come out of Colombia at that time, especially that had gotten sort of wider attention, you know, the Vampires of Poverty did screen at film festivals as well and got them some attention, but this was the first like narrative horror film to really come out of Colombia that got this type of attention. So I think that because it is so steeped in social commentary that a lot of people weren't quite prepared for that. An audience of today is certainly prepared to see something like this, but back then, not so much, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. And I also read some, you know, some interviews and some reviews with Ospina where a lot of his peers in the filmmaking, you know, at the time, as far as like in Colombia, there's not a whole lot going on because of, you know, Colombia's government and stuff. But there was kind of an animosity towards this collective because of how they, because of their dark humor and how they portrayed like a lot of the leftists in the government.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they found fault in how they portrayed and how they kind of exploited the poor and the lower middle class, just like, you know, the right-leaning politicians did.
Yeah.
So maybe that had something to do with a lot of, you know, negative reviews too, as well as just people like, fuck you, you know, I don't like you as a person.
Right.
I'm not going to like your movie.
Yeah. I think it goes back to like what you're saying about like the audacity that they have to, they'll really criticize pretty much everyone. While they do have certain leaning tendencies, if you are someone who is exploiting someone for your own benefit, then they would be critical of that.
Yeah, because they were on the side of the lower class and the poor. I mean, I think it's clear in a lot of their messaging.
Yeah. I know like this was kind of really quickly breezing through cast and crew, but honestly, this is more of a collective effort. I know it was co-written and directed by Ospina, so it is his film. He does mostly do documentaries. From what I saw, I think he is stronger in the documentary side. Puro Sangue, I think, is great, but his one other narrative film I didn't care for. But I do think it's worth kind of diving into the work that not only he has done, but Carlos Maiolo as well, and getting a sense of that, because it seems to be this sort of film collective and artistic collective of folks that don't really have that much visibility right now. Mm-hmm. And so me going through cast and crew and naming films probably isn't going to do much for our audience. So I did just want to highlight those few people from that group. So we'll actually get into our discussion of the film and some spoilers right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal: providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Where do you want to start with talking about Pure Blood?
I mean, there's a lot I love about this movie. Mm-hmm. It includes a lot of elements that I always love in not only horror, but in any movies. I want to personally just list a few of those.
Okay.
So first, I love the opening shot, which is very, it's just this very casual, matter-of-fact presentation of death and murder. Yeah. It looks very, it's like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, where everything looks real.
Yeah.
And that's what Ospina and Maiolo did with a lot. They would bend genres and do like kind of mockumentary style stuff, more so with like The Vampires of Poverty. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
But you can see it in Pure Blood. So that opening shot really sets you up, this like realistic look at murder. And then there's no dialogue for an extended amount of time. You don't, it's almost 9 minutes before somebody talks. So it spends time setting this mood with this great score. What you didn't talk about, I don't know. His name was Bernardo Osa, mm-hmm. I think. And then I think, I don't know if it's a brother or relative. There's a Gabriel Osa tied to it as well.
I think they are. They mentioned one of them in the documentary. And then they mentioned brother. And even like the artwork for it, there's a scene really quickly in the film where someone's like drawing in the hallway. And he's part of the Hollywood Collective. And what he was drawing, I was like, well, that, I wouldn't be surprised if he did the artwork, the poster art for this.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's another thing I love in movies is original art popping up.
Yeah.
But I think the composer, Bernardo Osa, I was trying to find stuff on him. I did find somebody from Cali, Colombia, Bernardo Osa. That was a four-time Grammy winner.
Oh.
And okay. I don't know if I think it's the same guy. Okay. It's the same location. Who knows? Maybe it's a common name, but yeah, anyway, I love the whole setup of no dialogue in movies. This does it extremely well. It's like I said, it's almost 9 minutes before the first line is uttered. Mm-hmm. So it takes time setting the mood and it just puts you in this zone, which I was through the whole movie because I think it's shot beautifully. And then, of course, there's a dark room in the very beginning. And I love dark rooms. People, you know, developing their own film. I'm a sucker for it.
This is like checkmarking a bunch of stuff for you. It's got costumes. It's got a dark room. And
it does. Yeah. It doesn't have like a fictional band performing.
No.
There's no, it's like it takes place during the new year. So it is kind of like, yeah, like you said, like a Halloween costume for, I guess, Columbia tradition. They dress up. Yeah, there's no twins popping up either.
No.
But whatever. But no, yeah, it just has all these elements. And a lot of it happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie. And I'm like, this is a good pick. I love what's going to happen. And also, they say Cartagena a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast. I think I have, but I don't know where it popped up. But I love the movie Romancing the Stone.
Okay.
Do you remember that with Kathleen Turner?
Yeah, I do. I just don't remember you ever talking about it.
Okay, because they always say Hotel Cartagena. And it rolls off the tongue. It just, and when they say it, I'm like, oh, it's it's orgasmic. When they say it. But yeah, there's a lot that I like about this movie. The grandfather, too, I know I didn't jump in when you were talking about, or I call him the grandpa because he reminded me of the grandfather from Willy Wonka, Roberto.
Yeah.
Who he's also referred to as the flea for, I guess, being a bloodsucker,
right.
Or he's like a mosquito.
Yeah.
You had said that he's, you know, based on, you know, that character Adolf or the real life serial killer, supposedly.
Yeah. Adolfo. More so the real estate baron. So it's a combination of that plus like the events of the serial killer happening that all sort of culminated that were all inspirations for this.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I had read an article from the director, Luis Ospina, who says, yes, I based it, you know, this is on pure blood. I based it on urban myths and mm-hmm. a little bit the character specifically of Roberto on Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
A character that lives secluded, watches movies, has long hair, long fingernails. Of course, his was a different type of vampire. And instead of fangs, they have hypodermic needles. And then he starts referencing like George A. Romero's Martin mm-hmm. and Abel Ferreira's The Addiction.
Yeah.
But I thought it was very interesting because I loved it when he was in the hospital bed and he kept yelling for the nurse to put on a film.
Yeah.
And he would watch. He watched Johnny Guitar first mm-hmm. and then they put on Citizen Kane. So I guess they are pulling that from like, you know, this idea of Howard Hughes, who was this hermit who just loved doing that.
I read that article too. And I was like, okay, I definitely see the Howard Hughes part. And like, I have a note about him watching Citizen Kane. And, you know, when he had that put on, he tells the nurse, like, turn this off and don't bring me any more black and white movies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is it because you don't like black and white movies, or is it because you see too much of yourself in this movie that you want to turn this off?
Right. That's what I thought too. I was like, there's got to be a message here. And I thought that too. Like, you know, you're this powerful man. And then I thought maybe it's because the age is getting to you. You don't like black and white movies. I don't know. But yeah, that was an interesting little touch from the director.
So getting back to the Christmas / Halloween party in the streets, candles burning, paper lanterns, fireworks, things like that. That's one of my favorite parts of the film, just because it's sort of this, like, I didn't know anything about how Colombians celebrate Christmas prior to this film. Apparently, it's like a month-long celebration. Or beginning of December 7th, is Noche de Velitas, or Night of the Little Candles, where they light all the little candles. You saw that one scene with Perfecto, them lighting all the candles. New Year's is celebrated by blowing up a doll. And so you have that scene of that lady where they blow up the doll and it's like, oh, we've killed the new year or the old year or something like that. So I think it's a clever way for people who are at least familiar with those traditions to understand the passage of time. So you have like, okay, it's been, we just had a scene where they were lighting the candles. Okay, it's early December. And now we've got the lady blowing up the doll and saying New Year. Okay, so now it's the beginning of January or January 1st. I tried my best to find any information about kids dressing up in costumes around this time. And there's nothing about that. Like, they do celebrate Halloween and dress up in costumes, except for those much more religious families who think it's, you know, the devil's holiday, which, you know, we have here. So whatever.
Right.
But I could not find anything. So if Podbean tells me we have no Colombian listeners, but if we get some, or at least one from Colombia because of covering this film, if you can speak to that part of the film with the kids dressing up around Christmas time in costumes and what that's part of, I would love to know, because nothing I searched for found anything. But I was like, the little kid in like the vampire mask and the Batman shirt.
Yeah. And it could be something completely fictional, because it is very literal with the vampire mask.
Right.
There's a lot of Batman shirts too in this
movie.
There are. And you know,
it could be very purposeful. There's a lot of heavy handedness in this, especially when it, you know, you have the kid dressing up like, I'm a vampire. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. That whole thing could have been just so to have this kid dressed up as a vampire. There's also these constant references to blood. You know, we mentioned like the fleas or bloodsuckers. Those are mentioned at the beginning after the three of them kill or kidnap their first victim, and they're going through his pockets and they see something, and they even call
Roberto
the flea, playing the Stones album, Let It Bleed.
Oh yeah.
When they go back. And even honestly, that's probably the reason this will never get a release, unless they can get some licensing for that. and then at the very end, when they're all they're having a picnic and the mosquitoes, and, you know, so it's a little heavy handed when it comes to the blood sucking references. I don't think it's necessarily needed, but I'm not mad at it, but I'm like, okay, I get it.
Yeah. It did pop up, and same thing, especially at the end when they started saying, these bloody mosquitoes are eating me alive. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
We get it here. But, I feel like maybe it's just hit on because it's a never ending cycle, and it does affect like every class, like high class, you know, middle class, lower class people they're being bled dry in some form or fashion. And like, going back to the kid who dresses up as a vampire, I feel like maybe it's some sort of representation of kids are not groomed, but, you know, they're taught from a young age that you have to be successful in life, you know, and maybe it's just this, you know, just like a theory of kids putting in their head that I'm going to be this rich and powerful vampire.
Yeah.
I don't know. Trying to make sense of some of this stuff.
What's interesting about this too is that, yes, this is a horror film, but there's a lot of it that is not in horror in the traditional sense. Like, the opening scene, it's haunting, it's bloody, there's no dialogue, like you mentioned. But the rest of the film, the only blood that you see is really like in bags that are being used for transfusions, minus one time where they show Hurtado throwing out blood and there's blood everywhere.
Yes.
But you know, for a vampire film, they're not, it's not very bloody in that sense, but that's because it's not supposed to be a literal vampire film.
Right.
I do really like it for that though, because it makes you think like what's more unsettling is like a literal vampire with fangs. It's, you know, can only come out at night kind of thing. Or these people who have, are in powerful positions, who can blackmail you, who are bleeding you dry. And I think that even comes out when they are constantly being called upon. Like, I can't remember, there's Perfecto,
Florencia,
and then
Ever, I think is his name.
Thank you. He's got a family and he gets called on Christmas and is like, we need blood for Hurtado. And he's like, it's fucking Christmas. Do you know what time it is? And so
yeah,
there's different levels of them being bled dry in that sense.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like it does. You can step back, like you said, and look at Lahore in the very beginning and the fact that these people are driving around town killing little kids to get their blood.
Yeah.
But yeah, the absolute horror is like just the rich exploiting and taking total control of the poor and the lower class.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, horrific. A lot of people may want to watch movies to escape that because it's very prevalent today, mm-hmm. like capitalist and, but yeah, I mean, I do, again, I think it's Ospina and, you know, the whole Columbia Collective doing this whole bending of genres where that's kind of a mockumentary style, but with pure blood, you like I said, that for that first 10 minutes, it starts off a pure horror genre, but then it becomes like this crime thriller with the whole Sugar Cane stuff. And then right. like almost like a mobster heist movie at the end where they start like blackmailing, you know, the son Adolfo. And it's very entertaining, but in the back, the whole underlying message is just this horror of the dead lower class.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's scary.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm jumping ahead to the end,
yes.
further emphasizing that is the fact that, I mean, there are consequences for Hurtado and his son Adolfo, sort of, you know, Hurtado dies because he's given bad blood on purpose because there's this other subplot about his Adolfo smuggling sugar into Venezuela and that goes wrong. So he needs money and his dad won't give it to him. He doesn't want to, you know, he's like, I'm not dealing with criminals. Mm-hmm. So then Adolfo decides like, okay, it's time for my dad to go so I can fully be in charge of this. So he swaps out good, bad, and bad blood. So his next transfusion actually kills him. But then he decides to kill himself, or at least try to kill himself, but he fails and he ends up mute, paraplegic, like just in the hospital. Like he can't speak, he can't move, but he's still alive. So he's almost like he's got trapped in syndrome.
Right.
But then he never gets caught for what he did, and neither do Perfecto, Florencia, and Ever. They never get caught for what they did. And again, like the Kali vampire never got caught. So,
right.
But I think like the purpose here is a couple of things. One is to say, well, yeah, the rich are going to keep doing this shit and they're never going to get caught. Mm. They're going to keep exploiting and never have to pay any consequences for it. But you have, at the ending, you have this man who comes and is actually caught and confesses to all of these murders that are happening. And so there's two ways I think you could look at it is that, and this isn't the ending. I want to talk about the end in a later, but the man who confesses, he's clearly unwell mentally. And so was it a case of he was actually just confessing and they lucked out and they're like, oh shit, well, I guess this guy's taking credit for it, so we don't need to worry about it. So they just luck out. Or was he also actually killing and raping people at the same time along with them? And they're just using this whole Kali vampire or monster of the wasteland as a cover for like, well, these are kills are just going to get lumped in with what is happening here. But the beginning, it clearly shows them like killing people because there's photographic evidence of it. So I don't know. Like I was like, I could see it going either way.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I feel like the man was obviously he was unstable mentally, but it almost seems like I almost took from it that while he could really be killing and raping young children, as he says at the end, he could just be confessing to this to you, because when he is caught and he confesses, there's a media platform on him and he starts talking about how he starts talking about how it doesn't matter because all these victims are lower class. All these victims are children from poor communities or poor villages. And it's almost like he's trying to portray this message of not incite people to like take a step back and look at what's happening. Like, yeah, I couldn't really determine what that whole confession meant.
Yeah, there might have been like a sense of martyrdom here to try to incite people to like recognize these things are happening. But Ospina, I don't think narrative storytelling is his strong suit necessarily. And so like the whole sugar thing was a little confusing. And then I think that ended like the message of there could also be something lost in translation as well, because obviously we're dealing with subtitles. So I don't know necessarily if it's not like the most clear and precise storytelling. I think there's some things that are very heavy-handed messaging wise, but then like the ending, it's like, that's where you want your most clear message to come through. It seems unclear with this guy who's confessing. It's like, what's his purpose? Like, do you want it to be this or do you want it to be this? Or do you want to leave us questioning it like we are right now?
Right. I think that probably is the intention of it. I mean, but the ending, there is some stuff that really made me step back. Like, and I don't know if we want to talk about, you know, obviously it's them. There's a lot of different layers to the ending. Mm-hmm. It's Roberto, the old man, the sugarcane plantation guy, the Dracula of the movie. He passes away with the bad blood and they're in the church. And one of my favorite scenes is when they're all in the church, the three murderers, you know, the whole family, the whole church is just full of mourners. And Perfecto nudges Florencia, you know, as the priest is saying, God will accept Roberto into his arms, you know, just praising him as this wonderful man. He nudges Florencia, one of the murderers, and they kind of looks, you know, motions to the window. Mm-hmm. And there's a poor family walking with a casket. The family's carrying their own casket of their, it's a very small coffin and they're carrying their child.
Yeah.
And it's just the poor with no, you know, no priest just praising the dead. It's just the poor burying their children.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. It's like, okay, everybody's praising this wealthy man. And then there's a child that's being killed, you know, who's not being told he's going to accept, God is going to accept this child with open arms. And then you jump to the scene where it's 1 year later. Mm-hmm. And it's the anniversary of Roberto's death. And at that point, his son, Adolfo, is, you know, like you said, he's in a vegetative state. He can't really reply or react to anything. And the whole community, there's a statue, like a bronze bust of Roberto.
Yeah.
And they're all putting flowers around him. And it goes back to the whole, like, the anniversary of this man's death. And they're treating him like a saint.
Yeah.
And it's like the wealthy will always get away with, you know, with generations to come, people build statues of these horrible people. And it's, I don't know, it's very thought provoking.
I think it's leaving. And that's like the end that I did want to talk about is people worshiping at Hurtado's grave, this bust of him. And I think it's, you know, it's not just of the man himself, but it's this idolatry of wealth and capitalism that despite the fact that these are the institutions that are corrupting and exploiting us, that's still what everyone wants. Like everyone is like, oh, he had so much money. He was so great. Like he's valued because of that. People aren't looking at the fact of, look what he did. He like, look at what his company did.
Right.
They basically, there's a sugar shortage because of their company and like them trying to make as much money as possible.
Yeah. No. And forget the fact that nobody knows that him and his family are murdering children.
Right.
To survive.
That too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's very frustrating because the rich need the poor obviously to survive.
Yeah.
But when you look at that final scene, the poor need the rich in order to survive too, like to have these positions and work in the fields, like, you know, terrible conditions. Like it's, and get paid to live. It's just, yeah, ugh, it's very frustrating.
That scene that you were talking about in the church where the family outside is carrying the coffin, I presumed, and I don't know, because time-wise, I'm not sure how long it was, but I thought like that was like the last boy that they brought into the hospital for the transfusion,
yeah,
to give blood. I was like, in my head, I was like, that would probably make the most sense for like, that's his family. And like, now they're both dead and he's being revered. And this boy is out there just like being hustled along by his family with no reverend out there blessing him or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the same thing. Like, that's gotta be the kid that essentially could have saved his life, but
yeah,
his son, Roberto's son, fucked him and gave him bad blood.
Yeah. Which medically, you know, and I did look into like what happens if you get a transfusion from the wrong blood type, and it was pretty much medically accurate, you know, throwing up blood and like just getting extremely ill. And yes, you most likely will die from it depending on how much of that blood would kill you. But I mean, that boy, his blood was a match for him. So it seems like though that one packet of the transfusion blood was enough to kill him.
Yeah. So, he's a frail old guy.
Yeah.
So I guess that makes it. Yeah. That scene of him vomiting blood. Did you ever see that short film, The Alphabet, from David Lynch?
No, I haven't watched
it. It's about like a little, it's black and white. I think it might be an old student film from the 60s, but it was based on a story was told either by, I don't know if it was a sibling or a family member that said, oh yeah, my child woke me up. She was screaming and I ran into the room and she was just saying the ABCs as fast as she can. A, B, C, D, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. And that's what inspired me to make this film, which is about this girl who's in bed and the alphabet's going on and she wakes up and just starts vomiting blood everywhere. And it's like, you know, red blood, very disturbing looking. And when I saw that, I was like, oh man, that's, yeah, I love this. Give me more of this. Give me more grandpa vomiting.
So one other thing I wanted to bring up about this film is a new term that I learned besides Collywood. I mean, that's more of a group of people that I learned about. But a few of the reviews of this film on Letterboxd mentioned the term tropical Gothic, which is that's a description I've never heard before.
Yeah, same.
But the minute I read that, I could picture it in my head and I knew exactly what it was. Like, I thought about I Walked with a Zombie right away.
Oh yeah.
And there's a few others that got mentioned. So I had to do some digging around to like find the origins of this term, but it is a literary and cinematic subgenre first identified by Filipino writer Nick Joaquin in his collection of short stories that were published in 1972 of the same name, Tropical Gothic. It, quote, more broadly constitutes a breed of Gothic within a specific geographical area of the tropics. Often these works have underlying social messages, usually related to European colonialism, but also related to class, wealth, politics, etc. And then in that, where I found that, they referenced a few other films like Murnau's Taboo from 1931 and W.S. Van Dyke's White Shadows in the South Seas from 1928. So those are more so about the colonial aspect. I think visually, when you're thinking about tropical Gothic, I Walked with a Zombie comes to mind. Pure Blood doesn't feel tropical in the sense of like, I guess I just, when I say tropical, I think palm trees and beaches.
Right.
But I think you could even look at anything that takes place in sort of like Caribbean, south of the equator, anything like where it's like heat oppressive. Because when I think like just straight Gothic, I think castles in Europe.
Right.
Vibe wise.
Same.
But when you think tropical Gothic, it's like, well, yeah, that works too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think, yeah, because there is the scene with the sugarcane fields and that's definitely tropical. Tying in the mosquitoes again at the end, that's very tropical too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interest that's, I've never heard that before. Tropical Gothic.
Yeah.
I like it.
Me too. So recommendation wise, I mean, Lance, you kind of touched on it already, but this isn't an escapist feel good horror film. This isn't one like, oh, I just want to turn something on and escape from whatever. This is not that, but I think it is still relevant. I think it's very well made, but this definitely is pretty heavy-handed when it comes to social commentary. So if you're one of those people who's like, I don't want politics in my horror films, then sorry, this is not for you.
Yeah, and so are a lot of horror films for those who say
hello,
that.
Every Romero film.
Yeah, no, I agree. I loved watching this. It's definitely another thought-provoking one. Like I think I already said, it's frustrating because mm-hmm. we're all stuck in this fucking system.
Yeah.
And this movie kind of, you know, makes you think about all those situations.
Yeah. What about a double feature pick with this?
I was thinking of doing picking a film where basically the rich kill the lower and middle class. You know, it's happening a lot in a lot of new movies. Mm-hmm. Ready or Not, there's The Hunt that came out, which I haven't watched yet. Some of the Hostel movies, you know, where just people of power just kind of torture and kill.
You're not allowed to recommend Eli Roth movies on this podcast, Lance.
I thought I'd bring it up, okay. But I knew I was going to get a reaction. That's why I brought it up.
Vetoed!
I'm going with the Spanish horror, The Week of the Killer, also known as Cannibal Man.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's the international title. And it's directed by Eloy de la Iglesia. And the main reason I'm pairing this is because of the realistic nature of the violence that is portrayed in Pure Blood. In Week of the Killer, it's just this calm manner. Like, it looks very realistic. But even on the top of the horror that's like casually presented, there's this dark humor hovering over it all. Mm-hmm. It's about a young man who works as a butcher. He accidentally kills a taxi driver, and his girlfriend wants to go to the police, but he panics, so he kills her. Then his brother becomes suspicious, so he kills his brother. Then his brother's fiance is involved and other members of the family. He just starts killing everybody. It's just this snowball effect, this tense kind of situation where this guy is completely in over his head, but he's trying to hide this secret. And he gets rid of these bodies by taking them to a slaughterhouse that he works at. It's from 1972, and it was filmed during the Franco's, you know, fascist Spanish government. Mm. So the director, Iglesia, he places a lot of social commentary, including like an underlying queer element to the story, which kind of pops up in Pure Blood.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just because of the way the horror is presented and the fact that there is a lot of social commentary with the government and the fascist government, I think it would pair well. Severin released this on Blu-ray not too long ago, but it's also streaming on Shudder if you're subscribed. But I love this movie. I recommend it.
Excellent.
What about yours?
Yeah, a few things crossed my mind. Maybe something like Blackula or Scream Blackula Scream for a more literal vampire movie, but still with elements of social vampirism in them. Maybe a tropical gothic film, like I mentioned earlier. So you have a tropical gothic double feature, introduce people to that term, and I'm like, what is this? And
yeah, that'd be good.
But ultimately, I landed on, I wanted something very light coming off of this film. So this would be the second one that I would put on. And that is Not of This Earth, 1957, directed by Roger Corman.
Oh, nice.
It's breezy 67-minute sci-fi horror about an alien race who sent one of their kind to Earth to collect massive amounts of blood to be sent back to the home planet. Their race is dying, and the human blood seems to be the only cure. So obviously there's a clear similarity to Pure Blood, but coming off of Ospina's film, like we mentioned, it's not a feel good. It's not escapist, but anything Corman is escapist, you know, it provides that for you. So it's like, okay, let's lighten in the mood a little bit here, but still have something about let's steal blood for our own good. So Not of This Earth, 1957, that's early Corman stuff, easy to find on YouTube or anywhere else really. All right. April Showers of Blood continues. Lance, what is your pick?
Scream Bloody Murder from 1973. This is written and directed by Mark B. Ray. It's about a disturbed young boy who runs over and kills his father with a farm tractor.
Oh, you've talked about this before for one of our...
I watched it. I think it was like 2021 for Horror Gives Back.
Okay,
it might have been like my 70s horror pick.
Okay.
But yeah, I remember watching it. I'm like, oh, this would be a fun pick.
Okay.
I rewatched it recently and I liked it even more. So I'm hoping people enjoy it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's about this young boy. He runs over his father, the farm tractor, killing him. And after the tractor runs over his dad, the kid jumps off the tractor and accidentally runs over his own hand, which he loses. He's taken to a psychiatric hospital where he's evaluated. He's given a sweet hook to replace his lost hand. And when he turns 18, he's released from the mental hospital and returns home to the farm and finds his mother has since remarried, which completely sets him off. He pretty much, he loses it completely. He goes on this killing spree pretty much. Then he sort of befriends and becomes obsessed with this artist who's also a prostitute, and he tries to impress her to make her fall in love with him. This is a very generic summary.
Okay.
I don't want to spoil anything. Yeah, like I said, I had watched this a couple of years ago and I liked it, but rewatched it again. And I'm like, okay, this is fun. This is a lot. This is going to be a good time for April Showers of Blood.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I don't want to spoil too much on this setup. Just watch it. It is on Tubi. It's also on YouTube. And this one does not have a release like we talked about earlier in this episode. So all the versions that are out there, they're pretty rough. They're pretty out of focus, but still okay. Completely watchable. And it currently has 666 views on Letterboxd.
Oh, hell yeah.
Sorry, we're going to have to change that.
Yeah, but man, that sucks. I don't want to be 667. Somebody else do it. Somebody else fall on that sword and watch it before me so that I don't have to be that person who bumps it up.
Yeah.
I don't want to break the seal.
Scream Bloody Murder, 1973.
Love it. If you are not already, you can follow this podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
You can follow me on Instagram and Letterboxd at El Shaibi.
Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you back for our next April Showers of Blood episode, Scream Bloody Murder.
Bye.
Bye. There's a crack in the mirror and a blood stain on my bed. There's a crack in the mirror and a blood stain on the bed. Oh, you were a vampire, and baby, I'm a walking dead. Oh, you were a vampire, and baby, I'm a walking dead. I got the ways and means to New Orleans. I'm going down by the river where it's warm and green. I'm gonna have a drink and walk around.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about 1,000 cats would look like?
It's called Night of 1,000 Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video! Woo!